And then Seema wanted to ask a question. So what I was going to do is direct you to quotation three. What we really need is just the end of quotation three. We said, he draws his conclusion. There's no fact about me. He distinguishes between my meaning a definite function by plus, and my meaning nothing at all. The options here aren't between my meaning this rather than that. It's being a dreaming state rather than a waking state. But it's between my meaning something determinate and my meaning nothing at all. Or it looks like it's the second conclusion that's looming, that's threatening. Sometimes when I've contemplated the situation, I've had something of an eerie feeling. And I want to just specify why you wind up with something like this, I think, philosophically, if you try to say something that has a phenomenological character at all. Here, there's things you can say about the situation. You can say, well, I thought it was like this, but it turned out to be like that. That was surprising. Conclusion that led to a discovery, that led to a conflict with my ordinary beliefs. Here, the very idea of our being able to mean anything at all is what's threatening. There isn't any way to formulate in a phenomenologically more determinate manner the character of your feeling without itself presupposing the availability of the abilities that are threatening to lapse. So there's a sense in which there is nothing to say here. The eerie feeling is a sort of an expression of, as it were, you know, a shiver going up your spine, which if you can, there isn't, you know, this is one of these moments in philosophy, as Wittgenstein puts it, where if you reach this point, then you just feel like making an inarticulate noise. For the noise itself to become more phenomenologically articulate is precisely for the situation not to be as bad as it initially seemed. And this, I think, can become even more explicit by just filling out the next bit of the column. Well, maybe I'll hold on that, because so, your question is about the eerie feeling. So, Simono, you wanted to ask me.
Well, yes. I think you partly answered it. But my question was about this. Cavell talks about the phenomenological striking features of the skeptical conclusion. He sort of thinks that one of them is that it's unstable, that it's sort of it's difficult to hold on to, but when. What the only thing Kripke says about the phenomenological features of his skeptical conclusions is that he gets this eerie feeling, yes. And that just reminded me of what Wittgenstein says about, well, when he sort of tries to entertain this Cartesian idea about people being perhaps not human beings but automatons, he says that this perhaps gives us some sort of uncanny feeling if we try to entertain it. Well, my question was about what kind of importance we should attach to these different ideas of the phenomenological quality of the skeptical life.
Right. Well, one thing is, one problem is, how much are we building into the idea of phenomenological quality? Kind of weighty conception of what it is for something to have a phenomenological character. The phenomenology has, as Husserl would say, intentional or noetic content, and we can characterize it. You can do phenomenology well or badly. You know, it itself is normatively constrained. And if you're within a Cartesian problematic, there's room for phenomenology. We have, as it were, if we're doing philosophy of perception, and actually whatever philosophical problem we're doing with a Cartesian problematic, there is a side of the Cartesian gap where we are securely located. The problem is crossing the gap. But on the side we're on, there's lots to talk about and do phenomenology of. If we're doing philosophy of perception, well, the worry is that I'm sealed off from the external world on this side of the veil of perception. But in this side, there's lots of phenomenology I can do. It seems to me as if in front of a fireplace. I can raise a certain kind of doubt about it. That I cannot answer that doubt seems surprising. Now that I think that that means that I can't actually ever say I know there's a fireplace, that seems like a discovery. That discovery seems, that belief that I seem to be forced to, conflicts with my ordinary belief. That involves this kind of instability, that we characterize here, that I can't convert to practice. All of that phenomenology, in a rich sense of phenomenology, depends upon the fact that in the Cartesian problematic, there's, as it were, a side of the gap on which things are fine. You know, I can talk and characterize and get things right. You know, this goes with the cogito. That I am thinking, that's not a problem. If we could say generically about the relation transition from a Cartesian to a Kantian problematic in any area, then what happens in the Kantian problematic is the stuff that looks unproblematic within the Cartesian problematic, sorry about that, awkwardness, itself comes under threat. Or a different way to put it is the Cartesian problematic always has a problem of inferring from something to inferring to something. I'm having a certain experience as if I'm from a classroom. Can I infer from that to there really being people in the room? It's clear that it appears to me that he's acting as if he's in pain. Can I infer from that to his being in pain? There's always a problem of a certain kind of structure and inference. Kant makes this, I think, very nicely explicit in Refutation of Idealism when he's discussing Cartesian problems of this sort that he calls problematic idealism. And what happens, you could say, in a Kantian problematic, is the base from which you were supposed to infer itself is problematized. And indeed, it's part of, I think, certain Kantian strategies. This is Kant's own strategy in Refutation of Idealism. To show Descartes, he thinks through his problematic. He can't sort things out to things that are on the one side and the other side as he wants. He couldn't even be able to order things in inner sense unless he could also order things in outer sense, that you can't have the side of the problematic you want without the other side in the way the Cartesian imagines. But initially in the Kantian problematic, if Kantian skepticism looms, then this side collapses too. If that's right, there isn't much left for phenomenology to mean. You want to say we're doing a phenomenology of that. It's sort of like faced with a Kantian, not doubt. We started with knowledge, I sort of skipped the step, doubt, Here it would be better to call this something like a boggle, as I suggested before. If you have a Kantian boggle, there isn't much, room to determine a phenomenology. If the threat, as he puts in this quotation, is your inability to mean anything at all, it's your inability to mean anything in your phenomenological characterizations, not just your characterizations of what the phenomenology is of. It's the of itself that's lapsing. Your capacity to have, things that, figure in of relations of that sort. It's intentional content itself that's going, to borrow Husserl's term. So if that's right, then the phenomenology winds up itself taking the form of a shiver, an eerie feeling, an uncanny feeling, an inarticulate sound. I mean, you can still call this phenomenology if you want. I don't mind. But part of what I'm trying to show you is depending on which problematic you're in, what we're even calling phenomenological characterizations are themselves quite different things that have a quite different kind of answerability. These things can be descriptively accurate in a certain kind of way. No, you're doing the phenomenology of the Cartesian, problematic wrong. If you're in the Kantian problematic, you can report a kind of a feeling. But if I say, no, it's not really an eerie feeling. It's more of an uncanny feeling. It's not really a shiver. It's more of a shudder. there isn't anything this is answerable to. This is a different kind of sort of first personal cry of anguish from the philosopher. It's not phenomenology in the sense in which this is phenomenology, where there really is a logos of the phenomena, even if we can't get to the noumena. There is no logos of the phenomena here we can do. I don't mind calling this phenomenology too. I did, you know, say it's the closest thing you get to a Cavellian, but the closest thing you get was meant advisedly when I said that. Now, you asked me about Wittgenstein. You know, all of this is ultimately in service of what I think of as a more satisfying reading of Wittgenstein. It's not what I was going to do now, so I'll just say something about that very quickly. We could talk about it more later. What I want to say is, both of these problematics are absolutely central to Wittgenstein. And that he thinks you need to treat, and he also thinks there's an important transition from the one to the other. So part of the reason all of this is going to count as skepticism is because they're not unrelated. The topic we'll be talking about Monday. And for Wittgenstein, a satisfying treatment of skepticism, I think, both involves Cavellian worries about how you get started here, and an exercise of forcing people up the dialectical ladder. Involved in what he calls the transition from latent nonsense to patent nonsense. That's all part of one thing. So it really depends upon what Wittgenstein we're talking about. So I think sometimes Wittgenstein is concerned with doing phenomenology in this sense. And sometimes he is concerned with moments where the philosopher is just left with nothing more than an inarticulate noise in the way Kripke, you know, is here. And I think it depends upon how you think through the case. And the case you've given so far is itself, you know, one that can figure in either register. If the worry is, you know, how do I know at this distance, you know, say I'm in, you know, Madame Tussaud's wax museum, and I'm walking around, and I've realized that that's not a person, that's a wax dummy of, you know, Queen Elizabeth I. And then there's a body, there's a museum guard over there. Or is that a dummy of a museum guard over there? That would be clever for them to stick a dummy of a museum. Sure, it looks real. Is it a dummy there? That's a Cartesian problem, you know. Which is it? That it could be one rather than the other is not the problem yet. Now, with a little bit of science fiction, I didn't need any science fiction for my example, but with a little bit of science fiction, you know, Star Wars scenario in place, we could get an analog of that going. You know, is that an automaton? Or is that a person on the model? Is that a dummy, or is that a museum guard or wax dummy of a museum guard? Is this Richard, or is this, Luke Skywalker's, you know, latest model of Richard X347. They use Richard as the prototype. Don't ask me why. They use Richard as the prototype for the new robot. Which is it, Richard? Is it the guy that looks just like Richard? It is Richard. That's a Cartesian problem. If the problem is, how could there be anything which is somebody's being something other than an automaton? What do we take the difference between automaton and the person to be? A person is expressing a pain. An automaton isn't really in pain. It's just simulating pain behavior. But if you get yourself into a problem where the issue is, what could it so much as mean for someone to express it? All we have are these bodies. The pain isn't here. Nothing could count as the expression of pain. So what we're getting is always just, you know, some matter in motion. It doesn't now matter, you know, whether the matter, you know, came out of a womb or out of a laboratory. Once it starts to shape up into a Kantian problematic, you know, how could there be something which is the answer to the question we meant to be asking when we were Cartesians? Is it an automaton, or does it really feel? You know, what it is expressing, thoughts and feelings, rather than just stuff is whirring around, and stuff in the outside is happening, which we call such and such, but now we no longer we mean when we call it that. If we get into that Kantian problematic about other minds, how could a body be anything more than a neutrally, psychologically neutral field, which we characterize in these ways, which we imagine to be more? Then you've got a Kantian problematic. I think the uncanny feeling attaches to what happens when we no longer can see human beings as different from stones in that way. And that is an issue in Wittgenstein. You know, that is, you know, just like the sign can go dead, as we were talking about with Primke, here it's a case of our view of the other as something that seems in itself dead, and we don't seem to breathe life. And that involves these kinds of characterizations. If we're still working in an earlier stage, where we have something that has the form of a Cartesian doubt, then there's much more room for a different kind of phenomenology of what the philosophical anxiety is in its more incipient stage. Then we can say things like, you know, my God, you know, I thought that, you know, and so on and so forth. Then we can actually, just like Cavell does, we can fill it out in some of the same ways. I realize that I can, you know, only know by analogy, you know, from my own case, what other people are feeling. And that means I can't ever know what they're feeling. So contrary to what we ordinarily think when we say, I know he's in pain, I can't ever mean that. It conflicts with my own. You can get all of that phenomenology as long as you've got things, you know, as it were, reined into the bounds of the Cartesian problematic. So I think your example, you know, automata doesn't tell us where we are. But I think what Wittgenstein is characterizing it in that way, where it's the uncanny rather than the surprising, when it's the has to do with issues of discovery, conflict, remarkableness, rather than inarticulateness. We're over here rather than over here. And both terrains are Wittgenstein. It's a mistake to think you need to choose. That's one of my worries about Cavell's criticism of Kripke. Is it looks like he's arranging a choice I don't think we need to make. Which isn't to criticize his typography of this side of the blackboard.
Well, I think so, because in this example I was thinking about Wittgenstein, if I remember correctly, he says that, you know, either the doubt disappears, and that would be the, yes, that column, or we get this uncanny feeling if we go on.
The doubt disappears, I think. There's another doubt that disappears in Wittgenstein, which is over here, which is that we see what the fateful first step is that locked us into the, you know, the initial doubt. The doubt here is the doubt that comes from, there is no way to tell. He's pretending he's in pain. There's really being in pain. There's in principle no way to tell. But it's a well enough made dummy. So it's the initial indistinguishability argument that launches the doubt. There is no doubt over here. That was my point. it's the initial indistinguishability argument that launches the doubt. That part of this treatment is to show you that that putative doubt, if we think, I haven't said anything about this in the class, but it's a fact about Wittgenstein. He wants to show us that we have something that has this apparent shape of the doubt here. But it involves a crucial step. You know, in the case of philosophy of language, it's the very point he's making in the later part of section 201 that Kripke doesn't quote. What causes the doubt in the philosophy of language is that another interpretation is always possible. Underlying assumption, all understanding of a rule, all understanding of science involves interpretation. It is interpreted. What does Wittgenstein say? There's a misunderstanding here. There's a way of grasping the world that is not an interpretation. That would make the doubt disappear. But that would make the doubt disappear by not taking the first, even the very first step in the Cartesian problem. Like that's what I think he's addressing there. So I don't think that's on either side of this. That's part of, there's a kind of treatment that Wittgenstein thinks needs to come in here. This is the kind of treatment he thinks needs to come in here, and you need both, and I haven't talked about either. But I think that's what you're touching on there. But my goal for today is more restricted. It's to stay sort of, you know, not discussing, as Or Wittgenstein's treatment of skepticism at all, just discussing skepticism and what it is. Say we want to use the word skepticism. What do we mean? Here's something Cavell is calling skepticism, something that has this logic. Here's something Kripke's calling skepticism, meaning skepticism, where the issue isn't how do I know he means this rather than that, but how is it so much as possible to determinately mean something rather than nothing? Just point out one more thing about the Kripke. How are we doing for time? Okay, a little bit more with Kripke and then back to Cavell. Racing along. So here we had conflict with our ordinary beliefs. We've reached a conclusion. We cannot know. We can doubt, we can dream, we can do those things, but we cannot know. Before we got too involved in philosophy, we thought we could know. Conflict. This is part of the point that Cavell is making in one of the quotations I skipped way back in quotation 9. The possibility of this conflict depends that we're using our words in the same way in the ordinary case. And in the philosophical, and when we're doing philosophy, we speak about knowledge, doubt, and so forth. And then we're reaching opposite conclusions. That's crucial. If the philosopher would just say, oh, the reason this is different from Austin's problematic is I'm not really talking about knowing. Austin's talking about knowing. I'm talking about schmoing. And then we think about schmoing, and then at the end of it turns out, oh my God, I can never schmo. Who cares? The reason skepticism seems to involve a discovery is we want to know, we make claims to knowledge all the time, and it's our entitlement to what we're talking about when we, you know, describe ourselves with cognitive verbs such as know and doubt and so forth in our ordinary concourse that is under pressure when the philosopher reaches his conclusion. But it looks like I can never know. So this conflict is essential to the Cartesian problematic, as Cavell is understanding it. Kripke's conclusion is not, there's something we thought we could do that we cannot do. Hence a conflict. Kripke's conclusion we better put as, there's something we cannot do, and it turns out we can't make sense of the idea that we can do it or that we cannot do it. The very idea of meaning vanishes in thin air. That's what Kripke says at the end of 4. And if the very idea of meaning vanishes in thin air, then a way we could translate this back from the philosophy of language case to the philosophy of perception case that Cavell's more focused on is the very idea of belief vanishes into thin air. Both the beliefs we thought we were forming out of the study and the ones we think we're forming in the study. The very possibility of conflict vanishes into thin air. That's the conclusion that Kripke's reaching. Michelle, you had your hand up.
Yeah, but Jonathan, I just want to say, isn't it that in the case you're now describing in Cavell's problematic that you can raise Cartesian question of if there is reality or how is the shape of the reality behind agreements, but in the, let's say, Cartesian version, you cannot even raise the question.
In the Kantian version?
Kantian version, you can't even raise the question. You cannot formulate the question either.
Any formulation you have itself is something that's been swallowed by your concern, that the words you're using to formulate the question themselves are not ones where you can distinguish with respect to each of those words, you know, whether you mean, you know, blank or blank star in the model of adequate. As Kripke says, the mathematical example is only meant to be a perspicuous case of something that involves our ability to use words generally mean anything, go on in the same way. Even to be talking about the same thing at the beginning of our exchange and the end of our exchange. That's absolutely right. Finally, maybe just with respect to the instability comment. If you want, you could certainly speak about the Kantian boggle here that Kripke's got himself in with respect to meaning as being unstable. That doesn't seem like a bad thing to say about it. But I think again, it's sort of a little bit like the point I was making about phenomenology. There's a similar point about how different what you mean by instability is now. Instability here meant we arrived at a certain determinate conclusion in our theoretical reflections on our cognitive powers. We enjoy certain appearances, we can doubt certain things. None of that's made very explicit as a conclusion, but it's there. But we cannot know certain things. But then, it said, that's unstable in the following sense. That when we go from theory to practice, we cannot help but act as if we did. But say you said, okay, don't act as if you knew those things. Just act as if they were 9.9999% probable. What difference would that make? None. the point isn't one about the content. The question is one about entertaining the content with a certain attitude as you move from theory to practice. The attitude of certainty, you might say. Whereas here, the instability attaches to our very capacity to entertain the thing we're trying to here call a conclusion in theory. Part of what that vanishing in thin air, the eerie feeling you're characterizing is, our philosophical reflections are pushing ourselves to a point where the very cognitive powers we have to be exercising in formulating the question themselves seem to lapse. That's instability in a different sense. This notion of instability is derived from this notion of conflict, which is derived from this notion of discovery. First you need discovery before you have the conflict. Once you start the conflict, you have the instability because you can't continue to believe the conflict once you leave the study. With each of these differences, another difference comes down the line in the Kantian problematic. I've only left myself 8 minutes to go back to Cavell. So I will do it quickly, and you can convince yourself of its merit by rereading the Cavell yourself. But what I'm talking about now is Cavell's essay on Kripke, The Argument of the Ordinary. And he says a lot of things, there's lots of interesting things in that essay. But I'm interested in the following moment of it for the next few minutes, which is Cavell wants to say something like this. He wants to say a number of things, but here's one of the things he wants to say. Well, here's one thing he definitely wants to say. Kripke has completely misread Wittgenstein. That's one thing he wants to say. and maybe I should just pause over that for a moment, not to disguise certain things I think. Kripke means to be doing two things here. He means to be posing a certain kind of, he calls it, skeptical paradox, explaining section 201. He then also goes on and attributes something to Wittgenstein, which he calls Wittgenstein's skeptical solution. Now, one of the things that Cavell's surely saying is, if you understand Wittgenstein, you would never attribute that skeptical solution to him. That's not what Wittgenstein's trying to say. I think, actually, about that right, about that, Cavell's just right. So I'm not, trying to defend everything Kripke's reading here. But Cavell on quotation one says, leaving out a few words, what Kripke calls the solution to the skeptical Western paradox is not Wittgenstein's. And if not the problem to which Kripke offers the solution, boy, I left out too many words. But this says something like, and if the problem to which Kripke offers the solution is not quite Wittgenstein's, if the solution isn't Wittgenstein's, then the problem to which Kripke is offering the solution is not Wittgenstein's either. It's much easier to read that if you don't want to. Now, this is just a non sequitur. It might be true in certain areas, certain well-defined areas of inquiry, certain branches of physics, If, somebody is not offering a solution to problem X, then he's also not addressing the problem. But in philosophy, you can't infer from the one to the other. Somebody could be very interested in a problem while not being at all interested in offering a solution of that form. You know, not thinking that's going about solving it in that way is going to get you anywhere. And I think, A, it's a non sequitur. But my main point isn't to just point out a fallacy, but to say I care about it because I think Wittgenstein is concerned about this problem. That's one of the things I tried to show you at the beginning of the last class, that you really do have this kind of Kantian problematic about meaning in the investigations, and try to show you the passages Kripke was deriving it out of. I do think it's in the text. But part of Cavell's, Cavell didn't just say that, he tries to give an argument for that. He tries to give an argument for that, which he schematizes a little more than he does, has the following form. Kripke's saying, Wittgenstein is concerned to constrain skeptical problems. I and Cavell agree with that. Here's one of the skeptical problems he's trying to treat. Skeptical problem about meaning. Okay. I and Cavell think he might be concerned with such things. Well, let's look and see if it's a skeptical problem about meaning. I've written a lot about this. I've really tried to characterize how skeptical problems work. How do they work? Well, they involve a certain kind of claim. The claim then comes under a certain kind of doubt. And that doubt has to be the right kind of example. It has to be directed at a certain kind of case, a generic case. It needs to precipitously generalize a certain kind of way. That leads to a certain kind of discovery. This involves a certain kind of conflict. This is, in essence, part of what Cavell's doing. He's reminding us of what skepticism and the way in which he's trying to characterize his early writings looks like. And then he goes to Kripke and he says, is that what we have here? And he answers, I think, quite correctly, no. No, this isn't anything like this. There isn't really a doubt. And you know, he hasn't chosen the right kinds of examples at all. He's got this completely free example about quadding. You know, it should at least be 2 + 2 = 4 if you want to do arithmetic. It shouldn't be this thing with this weird function. And you know, look what he has to say about his phenomenological features. I've tried to describe those in some detail. And all he has to say is that there's a kind of eerie feeling. Are we going to settle for that? And then, you know, he winds up saying the very idea of, in his case, since it's not, it's language, not perception, the very idea of meaning vanishes into thin air. And what Cavell's basically, I think, saying is, part of his argument, this isn't Wittgenstein's skeptical problem, is that it's not a skeptical problem. And part of his argument that it's not a skeptical problem is it doesn't have the earmarks of skepticism, as he's worked rather hard to characterize them in previous writings. And then what I want to say about that is, he's right about everything, except the conclusion. That, therefore, this is not... Well, a number of conclusions. One, therefore, this is not a skeptical problem. This is not a case of skepticism. And also, therefore, Wittgenstein isn't concerned with it. It's not, we've just mischaracterized what's going on at this stage. So, I want to say, yes, this is a kind of skeptical problem. But in order to be able to, but then, you know, you might say, but why call this a skeptical problem? If I could show Cavell there is a kind of coherent problem here, which he sort of missed the character of the dialectic of, at the very least he might say, okay, I missed that. But I was hugely misled by Kripke. I mean, it's not my fault, it's Kripke's. He called it meaning skepticism. Completely threw me off the scent. You know, that led me to look for something like this. Why call it that? So there's a further issue, which is sort of what is the unity of these problematics such that skepticism, you know, should be a term that ranges across both of them. And also, what kind of answer do we want to this question? What is the unity of the term? One thing you might think is, do we want a more abstract characterization of skepticism, such that we can see this problematic and this problematic as both being species of a common genus? It's going to be really have to be damn abstract, I think, to get that to work. No, I don't think that's a good way to answer the question. I think the unity, if there's going to be one, or as it were, a kind of commonality that brings them under the same heading, is going to have to be not, as in that sense, more general. It's going to have a dialectical character. You have to be able to show that these problematics are linked in some way. And that's what we'll be talking about on Monday. What we'll see McDowell thinks, in particular, is that if you think through this problematic, the deepest level is a point at which it begins to completely change its shape and to turn into this one. And you wind up with a different kind of problem, a different kind of question. That's one thing. The other thing I want to say on Monday, this is just preparation as you're doing the reading, is that when you look at Cavell, what I've said is that Cavell, I haven't said this explicitly, so I said, Cavell, when he thinks of skepticism, thinks of Cartesian skepticism. I think that does blind him. This blindness is particularly coming out in his reading of Kripke. But of course, if you have this blindness, I think it's going to have further costs. It's not just going to affect your ability to read Kripke, but it's going to affect your ability to read Wittgenstein. You know, the rule following sections, that paradox. You know, what is it? What's its shape? And even how the term skepticism works. If Wittgenstein is going to use this more inclusive sense, it's going to affect your ability to read Kant. If you think Kant is concerned to address the skeptic, which he certainly is, and you think that must always and only mean somebody who has this problem, that's going to shape your reading of a great deal of the first critique. So I do think this has cause, but you might conclude from that I'm saying something like this about Cavell. Cavell's just stuck in the Cartesian problematic. He kind of misses the Cartesian problematic altogether and misses that Wittgenstein's concern with it. That, I think, would not be right at all. So one of the things I'll also try to show you on Monday, going back and looking again at some of the bits of the Claim of Reason we've already talked about and which you read for last week, is that Cavell is very often working in a Kantian register. That is, his treatment of Cartesian skepticism does involve, as McDowell thinks it has to, a transition to the Kantian problematic. The concern with Wittgensteinian criteria is going to be connected with that. But what he doesn't see is that there's a kind of skepticism that can then articulate itself in that register, which can't simply be identified with Cartesian skepticism. That's just, if any of what I just said in the last few sentences is unclear, that's fine. That's just a coming attraction for Monday. And so I'm going to try to make those sentences clear Monday. Anybody who would like to stay and answer questions, I'd be glad to. Anybody who would like to leave, please feel free to leave. I'll make that clear by opening the door.
You've got 5 minutes.